And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
This week of the 4th of July is a terrific time to pay tribute to one of America's greatest inventions, its national parks. It's a good time to think about our national parks because our legacy is being hit hard by fiscal restraints. And despite the fact that parks continue to serve the public's need for recreation and recreation, this love affair is taking its toll on trails, visitor centers, rangers, and roads. So today, we focus your attention on the Grand National Parks as we turn our attention to a variety of parks that tell America's story when we return with your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
I'm a park person. Whether it be the local park we go to for a quick getaway, one of the thousands of state parks that hold the living systems intact, and certainly the great monuments to the best that humans can envision as tribute to life and wonder, our national parks. This past 4th of July weekend, literally millions of people visited national parks. And on an annual basis, almost every single U.S. citizen visits a park, statistically, with a population estimated at 295,734,134 as of today, July 2005. Over the past year, 276,900,000 visits were tallied. That boils down to 1,960 visits per day in each of the country's 387 park units. Of course, that's the way statistics see it. But some of America's greatest parks see some phenomenal numbers. When I served as artist-in-residence in Yellowstone National Park, each day during the summer, close to 40,000 visitors were in that park. It's a phenomenal love affair we have. The legacy of national parks reads like a list of bestsellers: Big Bend, Badlands, Bandelier, Blue Ridge Parkway, Bryce. And that's just some of the parks, starting with B: Yellowstone, Yosemite, Crater Lake, Canyonlands, Chaco. You could spend the rest of your life exploring our national parks and end up a better person for it. There are currently 387 national park units, and they preserve and share the story of America so amazingly. We have the national parks, but we also have national rivers and seashores. We have our history told in national historic sites and historical parks, as well as battlefields and monuments. There is so much that is ours, and that means yours. These are our national parks, and following the news, we are going to revisit some of the parks we visited here on the Wild Side News. So get ready to hear from some of America's greatest American storytellers following this week's summary of Nature News. And now, the news. From Anchorage, Alaska, comes the following story. Melting ice could destroy polar bear populations within the next century, according to an international panel of experts. If the current trend continues, the warming climate in the Arctic will erode sea ice, forcing the giant white bears to hunt seals from shore or onto smaller and smaller floes, the World Conservation Union warned last week. The group's outgoing chairman, biologist Scott Schleiby, whose job it is to oversee management of polar bears in Alaska for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, spoke clearly. "This is the first time that we have evaluated the plight of polar bears with respect to climate change, and we found that they were vulnerable to extinction. Scientists have observed that sea ice is losing its thickness, melted faster in spring and reformed later in fall, and that stretches near Alaska have become ice-free during the last three summers." And now to today's leading story. Leaders from the United States, Britain, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and Russia, otherwise known as the G8, are holed up at the Glen Eagles Lodge in Elkterotter, Scotland, to set goals and agendas for the world of tomorrow. Accompanying them, albeit at quite a safe distance, is the world's globalization response team, otherwise known as protesters. The dance between grandeur and street theater is, if nothing else, amusing. However, both sides will admit that the substance of their presence is serious. Prime Minister Tony Blair, the host of the event, had hoped to convince President Bush to join the consensus of world leaders who have pushed since Kyoto for mandatory limits on greenhouse gas emissions in order to force the world's industrialized nations to reduce global warming. The Bush administration, standing tall against any mandatory measures, has forced the weakening of the G8 mandate once again, eliminating mandatory limits and replacing them with goals, which are to be achieved through voluntary means. In a confusing mixed signal, the Bush administration last week touted its dedication to address the global warming issue by taking a strong stand for the creation of clean energy sources, favorite of which, for the administration, amazingly ends up as nuclear power, the new clean energy source. Needless to say, the expected outcome at the global level once again downplays the significance, much less the existence of, global warming. And in California, as we speak, California State Assembly's 11-member Utilities and Commerce Committee is voting on the popular Million Solar Roofs Bill, SB1, during a regularly scheduled hearing. If passed by the committee, it will go on to the General Assembly for a vote in August. If passed there, it will give California the claim for the largest solar bill ever passed. In an effort to reduce the effects of global warming, free the state's economy from the folly of global oil pricing, and create a new energy economy, Governor Schwarzenegger has shown a strong determination to get this bill passed. Generally supported by majorities from both sides of the political fence, the Million Solar Roofs Initiative requires all new home construction to include the option of solar and to provide a $2.38 tax rebate for every watt of solar energy installed. The bill, which is expected to pass by a significant margin, will establish a solid commitment with real economic clout to empower the emergence of a new energy future. Despite Americans' strong support for the Endangered Species Act that saved the bald eagle, House Resource Committee Chairman Richard Pombo from California is crafting loopholes that are a developer's dream. At least that's the statement that Defenders of Wildlife is making. "We are stunned by just how bad Representative Pombo's draft bill is," said Roger Schleicheson, president of Defenders of Wildlife. "The bill all but eliminates the federal effort to help endangered species and creates a whole new series of loopholes that enable oil companies, large-scale developers, timber companies, mining corporations, and other special interests to dodge the Act's protections." According to critics, the bill is filled with perks for the special interests. These include abandoning the national commitment to bring declining species back from the brink of extinction, sharply diminishing habitat protections for endangered and threatened species. It changes the definition of what constitutes an endangered species, provides giant loopholes that allow legal appeals during every step of the endangered species conservation process, and sets 2015 as the expiration date for the Endangered Species Act. To find out more about these proposed changes to the Endangered Species Act, you are invited to visit the website www.saveesa.org. That's www.saveesa.org. And guess what's been making tracks in one of America's great national parks? Theropods. That's right, those Tyrannosaurus Rex-like wingless birds that were trekking across the Alaskan landscape in Denali National Park 70 million years ago. It came as a bit of a surprise to Susie Tomsich, an undergraduate at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, who spotted the track on the underside of a ledge. "Something told me to look around, and I did, and I spotted this one," she said. The ancient footprint itself is not necessarily so unusual as theropod footprints have been noted in Alaska before. But it is the location. All previous theropod prints have been found along the coast. The inland location of this footprint suggests that this dinosaur may have decided he needed to get away for a bit, so decided to visit one of America's national parks for the weekend. And that's the news. Well, visiting a national park for the weekend is now more popular than ever in most national parks. And it's no wonder. With so much to see and learn, And in these complex times, let us always remember and never forget that time spent amongst the wondrous places is the most effective cure for a dull spirit or a tired dream. And that is why this 4th of July week, we want to remind you that you, yes, you own that park that's down the road from you. And you own every national park that you can visit in a day or a week, and hopefully for the rest of our lives. Now, I feature national parks on the Wild Side News every few shows. There have been some truly great moments. And today, you are being treated to a national park sampler. So, just in case you can't pack up and visit a national park in the next, couple days, here is a mini inspirational hour of national park moments. We start with a montage of historical notes as told by interpreters from your National Park Service. 96 National Historic Site.
Well, the people were coming literally by the thousands from particularly the British Isles. It was a time in the early 1700s when Britain, France, and Spain all claimed large portions of America, and they were enemies at the time. Those three countries were. The English were very determined. They meant to oust France and Spain from the North American continent. So they were very anxious for their settlers to populate portions of the English colonies, including South Carolina. So they made land grants available. The English government did. So many, many people wanted to start new lives, some for religious reasons, and just wanted to, in a sense of adventure. Many families traveled here. And by the 1750s and 1760s, many, many people from the British Isles were coming to live in the back country, which is what this was called, away from the coast of South Carolina. It was called the back country, and many people were coming to live here.
George Washington Memorial Parkway.
Well, George Washington Memorial Parkway is really quite an interesting park in the national park system. It's actually the parkway itself, which is about 32 miles long. It runs mainly in Virginia on the along the Potomac River, and it starts at Mount Vernon and actually goes all the way up to Great Falls of the Potomac, and it goes over into the Maryland side as well, with the sites of Clara Barton House and the Glen Echo Park, which is actually a turn-of-the-century Chautauqua and amusement park that's been converted into a park area.
Now, actually, the 30-mile journey includes a lot of memorials that people assume are just part of America.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk about some of those memorials as well that actually you administer?
We actually manage and take care of Arlington House, which is the ancestral home of the Custis Lee family. For those listeners, that's the individual. It's the home of Robert E. Lee and Martha Custis. And we also take care of the U.S. Marine Corps Memorial, otherwise known as the Iwo Jima Memorial. We have a number of other smaller park areas that probably aren't as well known. We have the LBJ, the Lyndon B. Johnson Memorial Grove. We have the Sailors and Seamen Memorial. All of these are along the Potomac River. Some areas we have Fort Hunt Park. Really, the range of cultural, natural, and recreational areas that we have within that 32-mile stretch is pretty astounding when people start looking at it.
Cane Creole National Historical Park.
The reason why this got national significance is they have managed to preserve not just the main house, which you might expect, but also a lot of the other buildings, the quarters where the enslaved people lived, the blacksmith shop, the pigeon houses, and hundreds of thousands of artifacts. So we're just now discovering what's here and starting to put it together. A visitor walking through the grounds might well notice something that nobody has noticed since the first, you know, perhaps enslaved person built it 150 years ago. It is very much a place of discovery. And I was thinking about how to express the depth of the textures here. And I'm thinking about if you find your way into, say, the North Slave Cabin, and the walls, originally, of course, they're bousiage, it's mud walls covered with cypress, but then on top of that, you've got layers and layers and layers of, we'll call it wallpaper, but it's a mix of cardboard boxes and magazine articles and newspaper and school projects. And just somehow the layering, there's so much obvious living that has gone on here that has not been cleaned up. It's just a very enchanting place. And the natural side, which is the thing to talk about today, is amazing. The pecan trees here, 100 feet high, and the live, I mean, they dwarf the live oaks. Yeah, it's just a very moody, enchanting, intimate plantation.
Sitka National Historical Park.
Again, one of the reasons why Sitka and the park itself are so important historically. In the year 1802, the Russians and the Tlingit had an agreement of sorts, not a very comfortable one, that allowed the Russians to build a settlement up the coast a little ways from today's downtown Sitka. Things went awry. The Tlingit ended up attacking that settlement and sending the Russians out of the area, reclaiming their home. But they knew, the Tlingit knew, that ultimately the Russians would most likely be coming back. And by 1804 had relocated their own settlement to near the mouth of today's Indian River, which is within the park. They built a fortification, and sure enough, the Russians did return. 200 years ago, the Tlingit in their fortification near the mouth of Indian River saw the Russian ships returning to the area. They relocated their fort to the mouth of the river for a very good reason. Along the coastline of Baranof Island, the coast is steep, and ships, even large ships, can get relatively very close to the beach. But here at the mouth of the river, the shoals extended quite a ways out into the channel. And by that time, the Tlingit knew the effectiveness of both cannon and musket, and knowing that keeping the ships a distance from the fort was in their best interest. And that's exactly what happened. The Russians saw the fortification, and at some point began firing on it without much effect because of, again, of that strategic positioning. Later on, a landing party approached the fort, led by Alexander Baranof, who was the chief manager for the Russian-American Company, who, again, were hoping to expand the fur trade here. Baranof himself was wounded as that party landed on the beach, and the Tlingit were successful in forcing the party back onto the Russian ships, where they sat and pondered what the next move ought to be.
Harry S. Truman, National Historic Site.
Yes, the home was basically kept the same after his death by Bess Truman. Harry Truman died in 1972, and then she died 10 years later in 1982. And the home was kept exactly the way they lived in it. There was no extravagance there, and you see that when you come in. It's like going, I guess, speaking for my age, it's like going to my grandmother's home and seeing the kitchen and the kitchen stove and the small table with chairs for two against the wall, a calendar there and a little clock and so forth. And then you go into the dining room through the butler, the area where the food was prepared and so forth. And the dining room was kind of interesting, and this is why we have other family members' homes involved with it, because the family ate together. The Wallace family would come over and have their dinners. They would always be dressed up in suits and ties for dinner. And then you walk into the living room and music room, and this is where he would have dignitaries come and visit him. They were never able to pass beyond that point because that was private and his family. But his friends and the neighborhood could always come in the back door. And we keep our group size down to about 8 individuals when they come through. We have no barriers or signs, interpretive signs. So it's as if you are being invited into the Truman home, and you get that personal sense by the small group tour and by having no signs and barriers there that you expect him to come around the corner and greet you.
Wow, that sounds so alive, actually. Is there something that you've come across? I know when you work in national parks, you get the privilege of really becoming very personal with these objects. Is there something that you've come across that stands out as just sort of touched you in some special way?
Well, I think the key thing, and I think it touches almost every person that goes through, is that when you walk into begin to walk in toward the living room, you look over your left shoulder, and there's a side door there, and there's a coat rack. And on that coat rack is Harry Truman's hat, coat, and cane, and they were left there the last time he took a walk, and Des Truman never moved them, and they're still there today.
Golden Spike National Monument.
Well, it truly was a great moment in American history. Two railroad companies, the Central Pacific, started in Sacramento, California, and worked their way east. The Union Pacific Railroad Company started in Omaha, Nebraska, and worked their way west. And these two railroad companies just overcame great odds as far as finances, terrain, and finding workers to, you know, complete the construction of the railroad. And finally, in this last burst of enthusiastic effort, they crossed northern Utah and met on May 10, 1869, and actually completed the Transcontinental Railroad 6 years ahead of schedule.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, how many people were at that event?
You know, that's a good question. Reports vary wildly. They vary anywhere between 200 to over 1,000. So it's really difficult to say. There was, you know, a group here that day, but there was so much trouble with reporters being able to hear. Of course, they didn't have sound systems, you know, that sort of thing, that we'll never be quite sure exactly how many people were here in 1869.
On the website, I have images of some of the engines actually as they exist at your site now. They're extremely, I call them extremely brightly colored. We don't usually see engines that are red and blue. Tell us a little bit about that, because I think that's an interesting story.
It is interesting, and it's one of the things that really draws people to this site. And they always ask us, you know, were these special locomotives that were created for the ceremony in 1869? And no, the two locomotives that were here in 1869, the ones that we have replicas, working replicas of now, they were that brightly colored. And I think it's important for folks to remember what time in America that we're talking about here. We're talking about the Victorian age, the Gilded Age, when there was, it's very important that things be very decorative, and if you had money, you definitely wanted other people to know it. And so that's what these locomotives were a reflection of, and certainly the Transcontinental Railroad was seen as, you know, this crowning achievement for America, and it was also a great advertisement for the railroads. And so it was very typical that locomotives of that time were very, very brightly colored, very highly decorated. And so our replica engines here are a reflection of that time and truly a reflection of the two original locomotives, the Jupiter and the number 119.
There is something for everyone in your national parks. When we return, we give tribute to one of our nation's fascinating historical parks as we head to Baltimore, Maryland, and hear from one of the nation's most inspired interpreters who adds his voice to the voice of the earth here on the Wild Side News.